This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tom McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden will withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on America that were coordinated from that country. That's according to several U.S. officials Tuesday. That decision defies a May 1st deadline for a full withdrawal under a peace agreement the Trump administration reached with the Taliban last year, but it leaves no room for additional extensions. A senior administration official called the September date an absolute deadline that will not be affected by security conditions in the country. While Biden's decision keeps U.S. troops in Afghanistan 4 months longer than initially planned, it sets a firm end to 2 decades of war that killed more than 2,200 U.S. troops, wounded 20,000, and cost as much as $1 trillion. U.S. President Joe Biden is calling on Russian President Vladimir Putin to de-escalate tensions following a Russian military buildup on Ukraine's border. The White House says Biden told Putin in a phone call Tuesday that the U.S. would act firmly in defense of its national interest regarding Russian cyber intrusions and elections interference. Biden also proposed a summit meeting in a third country in the coming months to discuss the full range of U.S.-Russia issues. There is growing concern in the West about a surge of ceasefire violations in eastern Ukraine, where Russia-backed separatists and Ukrainian forces have been locked in the conflict since Moscow's 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. This is VOA News. An Iranian nuclear negotiator says Tehran will begin enriching uranium up to 60% purity after an attack on its Natanz nuclear facility. That's a higher level than the program has enriched to before, but remains short of weapons grade. Abbas Araghchi's announcement Tuesday marks a significant escalation of the sabotage suspected to have been carried out by Israel. It could result in further action by Israel, whose Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed never to allow Tehran to obtain nuclear weapons and further raise tensions across the Mideast. Iran's foreign minister earlier warned that the weekend assault could hurt ongoing negotiations over its tattered atomic deal with world powers. U.S. federal health agencies Tuesday recommended pausing the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine for at least a few days after 6 women under age 50 developed rare blood clots after receiving the shot. Johnson & Johnson said it would delay rollout of the vaccine to Europe a week after regulators there said they were reviewing rare blood clots in 4 recipients. U.S. President Joe Biden will address a joint session of Congress later this month for the first time in his presidency. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's invited the president to share his vision to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday, April 28th. The speech will come days before President Biden's 100th day in office, giving him an opportunity to update the country on his progress. It's also a chance to make his case for the $2.3 trillion infrastructure package he unveiled earlier this month. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, the address is expected to look different than a traditional joint session when members of both chambers cram into the House. Some internet critics have questioned why Biden hasn't given a State of the Union address, but in the last several decades, every president has waited until their second year in office to deliver that speech. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
A use of force expert says that former officer Derek Chauvin was justified in pinning George Floyd to the ground because he kept struggling. The witness Barry Broad testified Tuesday for the defense in Chauvin's murder trial. He contradicts a parade of authorities from both inside and outside the Minneapolis police force who said Floyd used excessive force and violated his training. At one point, he suggested that if Floyd was being compliant, he would have had both hands in the small of his neck and just resting comfortably. By a remote, I'm Tommy McNeil.
We'll be right back. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 14, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Outrage in Mali over the assassination of a rebel leader that some are calling a peacemaker.
This is to say that this man did not have the appropriate security details in Mali, that strategic partners of Mali or even Malian playing key role are not protected in this country, and that is really outrageous.
A student is dead following a school shooting Tuesday in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Villagers complain about the impact of the Uganda-Tanzania oil pipeline, and yet another appeal for hundreds of thousands of people affected by conflict in Mozambique.
As the security situation continues to deteriorate, more than 950,000 people in the north of Mozambique are now facing severe hunger.
And Zimbabwe schools are hit by a surge in COVID-19 infections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malian politician is expressing outrage over the assassination of a rebel leader that some are calling a peacemaker. Sidi Brahim Sidati, leader of the Coordination of Azawa Movements, was shot Tuesday morning outside his home in the Malian capital, Bamako. Opposition politician Yao Samake says the Malian government should have provided security for Sidati.
The tragic killing of Sidi Brahim Ould Sidati, president of the Coordination of Azawad Movement, is a tragic event, and I am particularly sad for what happened. He got shot by gunmen who were not identified and on motorcycle in front of his home in the capital city of Bamako. I extend my condolences to the family of the deceased.
Do the authorities know who did the shooting?
The authorities in Mali do not know who did the shooting, and no one armed group claimed the shooting. The government of Mali is still investigating and trying to find out what happened and who did it. This is tragic, and it is deplorable that we live in a country where, even in the capital city, that the government is not protecting key players of the peace process that Mali has signed in. Sidati was the president of the SEMA, which is one of the signatories of the peace agreement in Mali, and that he could be killed in his home in the capital city of Mali without the government even knowing who did it or apprehending the killers is outrageous. This is to say that this man did not have the appropriate security details in Mali, that strategic places in Mali are not protected, and strategic partners of Mali are, or even Malian playing key role, are not protected in this country, and that is really outrageous. So I call on the government to quickly investigate and track down those killers and bring them to justice.
You said that Sidati was a major actor in the Mali peace process. What exactly was his contribution to the peace process?
Sidi Ibrahim Ould Sidati was a major player in the peace process, as I've said. He was the president of the Coordination of Azawad Movement. He was a signatory of the peace agreement in Mali and was working on, actually member of the commission, on the follow-up commission on the peace agreement. And I believe that this killing will be a setback in the peace process in Mali. The SEMAS is an alliance of rebel groups who were seeking autonomy for the northern part of Mali. But with the help of the international community led by Algeria, we came to a peace agreement in 2015, which was signed by the SEMA group in June of 2015. So obviously, this killing would be a setback for our peace process, but I can only hope that the signatories, including Mali government, will regroup very quickly and be able to give assurance that this incident will be resolved and the perpetrators will be brought to justice.
You also said that Sidati should have been protected. Who do you think should have protected him?
I believe that Sidati or any Malian citizen should be protected by the government of Mali, and they are the number one responsible for the security and the safety of the people of Mali. Now, Sidati's case as a key player in the peace process, I believe that the government should have provided added security measures to make sure that his life is not in peril, and that now all members of these signatory parties living in Boko under government protection. This looks like a neglect, and government should clarify its position and also making sure that there is assurance that key contributors to Malian political and security issues are protected.
Yao Samaki is a Malian politician. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bamako. There was a school-related shooting Tuesday morning in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, including minors. Leonard Dodu, newsroom chief of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper, says a 16-year-old girl is dead and police are holding two 16- and 17-year-old boys.
This shooting incident that occurred in Monrovia on Tuesday early morning is the first of its kind. It occurred at a school called the Cyber Ed Christian School of Excellence, which is located right behind the home of Liberia's vice president. The school, like most Liberians will consider it, is a school that mostly the children of the upper class do attend. So it's an international school. The incident occurred about 7:45 a.m. We have gathered from the police, and it occurred at a time where most of the students in the school had gone to do their breakfast before school could start. And this student in question left where they were having their breakfast and went to the classroom, according to the school authorities, to show off with the 9mm pistol that he sneaked onto the campus with. And while at it, he mistakenly, according to the school administration, fired a shot that killed one of the students.
Who is the victim? And
the victim is a 10th grade student at the school, who also happens to be the daughter of one of Liberia's famous doctors called Dr. Philip Ireland. Dr. Philip Ireland is the head of the internal medicine at Liberia's biggest referral hospital, the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center. He's also one of the doctors who was very active in helping people to recover from Ebola in 2014, and he contracted Ebola and survived.
How is the police investigation going?
On Tuesday morning, the anti-robbery unit of the police picked up two students from the school who are suspected to have connection with the shooting. The students, both of them minors, age 16 and age 17, are being investigated by the police. They are currently in police custody. Being that they are minors, the police also said that the parents of these children who live in the United States of America are cooperating to bring their legal representations, that is their lawyers, before statements can be extracted from the minors.
Is this an isolated case, and what is the policy in Liberia about students bringing guns to school?
This case is very isolated. As a matter of fact, it's the first of its kind, and this was also confirmed by the Minister of Education, who said that this has never happened in Liberia's history, as far as he's concerned. Carrying weapons to school is totally prohibited in Liberia. This is not permitted. Students are not allowed to carry even mobile phones to school. So how he got hold of the gun is one concern that the public has, that how did a 16-year-old obtain a gun? The general public is very much concerned about that, and they are also awaiting answers from the police. And how he entered the school campus with the gun without being noticed is another concern that the public has. So this is strange. This has never happened before. Somebody will say, yes, I mean, Liberian students might take razor blades to school to sharpen their pencils, but never a day has there been any report that any student used a razor blade on another student. So using a gun on another student is very, very strange in our society.
Thank you so much again, Leonard, for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you so much, James, for having me. It's my pleasure speaking to you this morning.
Leonard Dodu is newsroom chief of Liberia's Front Page Africa. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. United Nations agencies says northern Mozambique is facing a long-lasting humanitarian and protection crisis as conflict, hunger, and disease grip hundreds of thousands of people in the region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
People are still fleeing in droves from the impact of the violence that erupted in northern Mozambique's coastal town of Palma. Many of the thousands of people who have fled to Pemba, the capital of Cabo Delgado, tell stories of the horrific attacks by Islamist militants who reportedly killed dozens of people and committed other atrocities. Speaking on a video link from Pemba, Director of Emergencies for the UN Children's Fund, Manuel Fontaine, relate how they have had to flee in the middle of the night. They speak in sorrow at families being separated while running for their lives.
I heard about this young woman was pregnant, and her husband was just stories of people being kidnapped, and horrific stories of ordeals of people walking for days and days, kids arriving with their feet swollen and injured and having to be taken care of.
UNICEF says malnutrition rates among displaced children in Cabo Delgado are alarmingly high, with at least 33,000 in need of life-saving specialized nutritional feeding. It says cholera and COVID-19 are of growing concern. The agency has appealed for $52.8 million for Mozambique this year, $30 million of that amount targeted for Cabo Delgado. It says only 37% of the appeal is funded, and international support for its humanitarian operation is urgently needed. In a separate appeal, the World Food Program is seeking $82 million to ramp up food aid in northern Mozambique. WFP spokesman Thompson Theory says in the wake of the heinous attacks in Palma, families and individuals have had to abandon their homes, their belongings, and livelihoods to flee for safety.
WFP teams on the ground have spoken to these families that are on the move, and their stories illustrate horrific violence and deepening despair. As the security situation continues to deteriorate, more than 950,000 people in the north of Mozambique are now facing severe hunger.
Theory says the WFP plans to assist 750,000 internally displaced people and vulnerable members of the host communities in Cabo Delgado and three other northern provinces. He says WFP is organizing emergency food distribution for families who have fled the violence in Palma. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 14. Chinese and French oil companies involved in the East African crude oil pipeline project to be built from Uganda to Tanzania say affected villagers are being compensated. But rights groups representing hundreds of families who will be displaced by the project tell a different story. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
The $3.5 billion project is projected to run 1,450 kilometers from the southwestern Hoima district of Uganda to the port of Tanga in Tanzania.
I'm greatly honored to join you today.
On Sunday, Presidents Yoweri Museveni of Uganda and Samia Suluhu Hassan of Tanzania signed three agreements paving the way for construction of the pipeline, expected to be completed in 2025. Chitutu Mary Goretti, Uganda's Minister for Energy and Mineral Development, says the agreements will be a significant boost into Uganda's economy and its people.
Other processes are already ongoing, including the acquisition of land for the pipeline and the EPC management activities. It is important for the people of Uganda to take note of and position themselves to benefit from the extensive activities already going on.
However, human rights organizations say pipeline construction will displace up to 10,000 people who are not being adequately compensated. Sewanyana Livingston, the head of the Foundation for Human Rights Organization, says locals are not being heard.
Of course, the population along the pipeline are interested in compensation because they were displaced, they were not heard, they are not party to the negotiations. We are trying in our follow-up activities to see how Total can bring them on board. But at the moment, they seem to be excluded.
According to the agreement signed Sunday, French energy company Total will hold the largest stake in the pipeline with 62%. The Uganda National Oil Company and Tanzania Petroleum Development Corporation will hold each 15%, and the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC, will own the other 8%. Pierre Jessua, Total's general manager, says the company has not voluntarily delayed the compensation to the affected families.
It was, due to the stop and goes of this project that we had to interrupt the processes, but we never actually took the lands and deprived the people from the land. We have evaluated the land, evaluated the crops on the land, evaluated the buildings which were on the land.
Chen Zhuo Biao, president of CNOOC's Uganda branch, says very few people in their areas of jurisdiction are yet to be compensated.
We have already compensated most of the people that related to the land. And along my memory, only about 26 households did not compensated.
Upon completion, the East Africa crude oil pipeline will be the longest in the world, carrying 230,000 barrels of oil per day from Ugandan oil fields to Africa's east coast. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Zimbabwe schools are being hit by a surge in COVID-19 infections after reopening, despite criticism that they weren't prepared. Ade Gondo has details.
According to the Health Ministry's situational report, two schools in Matabeleland South reported 106 cases of COVID-19, reigniting fears that schools were not ready to resume classes. Umzingwane High School and Sacred Heart Girls High School in Eskodini reported a combined 106 cases. Despite the ministry's assurances that the situation is under control, teachers' unions and others say that's not the case. Schools reopened on March 15th with students attending on alternate days as the government eased some COVID-19 restrictions. Masks, temperature checks, and washing of hands in all public areas remain in place. A national vaccination program is being rolled out. But teachers' unions have long raised questions on whether proper precautions were in place. Yesterday, a statement by the Progressive Teachers Union, PTUZ, blamed the Ministry of Primary and Secondary School for the new cases, saying COVID-19 abatement equipment in schools is in dire need. The union's president, Takawa Firajo, weighs in.
The $750 million that the government allocated to schools to buy COVID equipment seem not to have filtered to the school. It seemed to have gone into private pockets. The classes in schools are still bloated, with some teachers teaching a class of about 103 students, 90 students, and this has ensured that there is no social distance. The Minister of Education has also not recruited more teachers in order to ensure a proper teacher ratio of 1:20 is encouraged by WHO. There is no running water in schools.
Before schools reopened, ministry officials claimed they had found a high level of preparedness, a point teachers' unions reject, saying, for example, teachers, ancillary staff, and pupils were not tested. Obed Masaraure of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Unions of Zimbabwe, R2s, also said schools reopened too soon.
We warned the government of Zimbabwe against the reckless opening of schools, but they didn't take heed of our call. We were pushing for mandatory testing of all those who were going to participate in the physical school ecosystem. Unfortunately, our government chose to blindly accept both learners and teachers. It is a fact that our schools are now the super spreaders of COVID-19. It is a fact that if there's a third wave, it is being brewed in our schools.
Observers say urgent action is needed, saying it will be more costly to manage COVID-19 than to prevent the spread. Meanwhile, Masaraore confirmed that demand for vaccines is sluggish.
Very few teachers have been vaccinated. There's limited access to information on the vaccination program. And there's still a lot of skepticism on the vaccines themselves. So there was need for a lot of education so that at least we have more uptake of the vaccine by the teachers.
Observers say fractious relations between the government and its workers is in part to blame for the situation. They say dialogue would help mitigate the trust deficit. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The idea for the Collective for the Renewal of Africa, also known as CORA, began 1 year ago when three African intellectuals wrote an open letter about the pandemic and advising leaders to use it as an opportunity to change the paradigm. The positive response to their letter led the thought leaders to expand upon the idea, and CORA, Pan-African Intellectual Collective of over 100 writers, scholars from the social and natural sciences, medical doctors, and artists from across Africa and the diaspora officially launches this week as an ongoing collective with a series of conversations hosted online. Ndongo Sila, co-founder of CORA, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the group.
And you know that, yeah, we don't have the same economic structures. Our economies are strongly dominated by the informal economy. So if you implement harsh lockdown measures, you could harm much more than the virus could have done, you see. And so we are having this kind of conversation with the African leadership. And this open letter had been signed by 100 African, let's say, scholars, public intellectuals, etc., from the continent and the diaspora, and from all linguistic areas. That means the Francophone, Anglophone, Arabic-speaking, and also Lusophone countries. And that was something really amazing. And because we had a tremendous success, that was initially unexpected, you know. And that message was very powerful from our side, because it meant that people are expecting something from African intellectuals, because actually, at least now, African intellectuals are starting collectively to have an opinion about what is going on in the continent. And we saved that message, and we told ourselves we could not stop there. We have to build something about, let's say, around, let's say, this open letter. And that's the idea of CORA.
What is different about this collective?
Yeah, what is, I think, different, specific to CORA, is that our members are from the continent and the diaspora. And CORA reflects the linguistic diversity of the continent. That means we have Arab-speaking, Portuguese-speaking, French-speaking, English-speaking, etc. And we are also we have also all the spectrum of, let's say, competencies. We have people from the natural sciences, economists, historians, let's say, physicians, etc., and also artists.
Some of the topics addressed in your first forum are indigenous languages, indigenous approaches to solutions, and biodiversity and economics. Why have you chosen these specific issues for this first meeting?
Yeah, somehow it is linked to the actuality of the pandemic. You see, for example, when the pandemic started, it was, let's say, global selfishness. Every country, every regional bloc say that I have to handle things myself, and after, yeah, international solidarity will come afterwards. And so Africa was left to two-three times much more vaccines than what is available for the African continent. So that means that Africa has to develop its own capacities, economic capacities, etc. And this has been revealed, let's say, clearly by the pandemic. So it's important that Africa gather its own resources in order, let's say, to have much more sovereignty, much more, let's say, technical capacities in all those areas.
That was Ndongo Sila, a co-founder of CORA. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, April 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.